Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. We got a big show for you today. All returning champions, but we're excited to have them all back. It's he's an editor at Dark Horse, specializing in their Japanese publications, manga, novels, art books, things like that. It's Carl Horn. Carl, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. And we've also got the crew from Colony Drop. You can also see their contributions to Otaku USA and the Otaku USA sort of e-newsletter that goes out. We've got Matt Schley. Matt, thanks for showing up.
Thank you.
And Jason Moses.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, Sean Amaro.
Hi, Zach. How's it going?
Oh, no problem. That's not an answer to how's it going.
I'm also glad that I get to be a returning champion. You know, I'm just getting the bonus here without
it's
actually
like
having to do anything. Yeah.
All right, then. So, chiefly, we're kind of here to talk about one film, which... Carl and some of these guys put together a zine for it last year, not unlike the Colony Drop zine, just to celebrate Royal Space Force, the Wings of Onyamas. But before we get to that, I know Carl and Matt at least have seen The Wind Rises, the latest and particularly controversial Oscar-nominated film from Hayao Miyazaki. Latest and, I guess, final. We'll see if it's actually his final film. The Wind Rises. So, Carl, I'm really, really dying to hear what you thought of this movie.
Well, before I get to that, I just want to say something about ANN Cast itself. Have you had the chance to read Jonathan Clements' new book in the history of anime?
I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but I know he was very kind to us in there.
I know, and I just wanted to say that in the beginning, in the acknowledgments, he singles out you and Justin for thanks. He said that ANN Cast says... I think what he said is it, quote, constantly fed me new ideas and information. And the reason I want to sort of make a note of that is it's a lot of work for you to do the show week in and week out. And Jonathan Clements, he's highly fluent in Japanese as well as Mandarin. He's got decades of experience in anime. He's a professional translator, an author, a journalist. And when it comes to finding out things about anime, he's somebody who can just go to Japan. He can track down information there and talk directly to Japanese industry figures and look at archives and library records. And ANN Cast, of course, is a North America-based show, and it's in English. So for him to talk about how valuable the show is, I think that shows you're really, you know, doing some great work here. I know you believe in it, or you wouldn't keep doing it, but I think that's a great vote of confidence, and I just want to let people know about that.
It was tremendously flattering, and both Justin and I were deeply humbled by that whole thing. So I appreciate you mentioning that. Well, I'm dying to know what you thought of this movie.
Okay, Wind Rises. Right. So right now we're having the International Film Festival up here in Portland, and The Wind Rises was chosen as one of the two opening night films. This was also the night the first snowstorm of the year began in Portland. But I trudged there through the snow just so I could say I trudged through the snow to see the film. It was, I felt like the sad girl in the visual novel. It was very touching. As an otaku, you know, because there's been a lot recently about Miyazaki and otaku and all that, I had trouble relating to The Wind Rises. So they clearly establish at the beginning of the film the protagonist has a younger sister, and yet he ends up marrying someone else. Like, after that, just nothing made any sense.
All right.
Okay, the movie gave me a lot to think about. They say people don't become painters because they see a beautiful landscape and are inspired to say, I'm going to paint that. They become painters because they see another artist's depiction of a beautiful landscape, and that inspires them to become a painter themselves. Miyazaki was almost the reverse for me. I saw the first movie of his I saw, I was 13. It was Nausicaa in 1984. And when I went out of there, I found myself looking at the real sky in a different way. Like, he's a director who had me looking at hills and seas and like skies with like fresh eyes, because he was sort of evoking the kind of, you know, even though these were animated films, these were science fiction films, these were, you know, these had fantastical elements, he was sort of evoking the kind of the joy of flight and the idea of sort of, you know, soaring above the earth. And so it's almost like he wasn't, as an artist, he wasn't taking me into a fantasy realm. He was saying, hey, look at the real world. You know, the real world is really beautiful, you know, and very interesting. And I don't think I had encountered a filmmaker before who had kind of done that. I guess other filmmakers could give you that same impression, but as for me, I got it from Miyazaki. So because I first saw a Miyazaki film when I was 13, in a way, I kind of think that I, you know, in a way, grew up with him the same way that, you know, people have in Japan for the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. This movie was a little bit different. As I guess most people know, The Wind Rises is inspired by the career of Jiro Horikoshi, who was part of the early generation of aviation engineers in Japan between the two world wars. And most of the movie takes place in the 1920s and 30s when Horikoshi was working at Mitsubishi. People know them for their cars, but they're a company that does all kinds of engineering and manufacturing, including aerospace. It was Horikoshi who designed the most famous Japanese fighter plane of World War II, the Zero. When the Zero became operational in 1940, Horikoshi was 37 years old, which I realize is actually younger than Miyazaki himself was when he got to direct his first movie, The Castle Cagliostro. I saw at the end of the film that one of the people Miyazaki dedicated the movie to was Jiro Horikoshi, presumably the real one. That seems natural enough, but what interests me about the dedication is that so many of the elements of the film are deliberately fictional. If I'm not mistaken, the other person Miyazaki dedicated the film to was Tatsuo Hori, the person who wrote the original 1930s novel The Wind Rises that Miyazaki used to develop the love story that's in the film. The original novel, if I understand correctly, didn't have anything to do with the real-life Horikoshi. So he sort of fused those two elements, you know, to make the film. It also occurred to me that Hori's, who was the author of the novel, he actually looked a bit more like the movie Horikoshi than the real Horikoshi did. And maybe by dedicating the film to both of them, he wants to sort of put out that statement that the movie was indeed made as a literary evocation of Jiro Horikoshi, and it was only in a partial sense about the actual person. And why is this important? I mean, it's something we should look at beyond just the usual issues of dramatizations, because the person he chose to fictionalize in The Wind Rises, he wasn't just this brilliant engineer. He was somebody whose work helped to shape the course of the Second World War. You know, some of that, what I mean is, of course, in The Wind Rises, you have these great magical realist sequences of Horikoshi's dreams and visions. They take you out of what you might call any sort of strict biographical mode. Now, Miyazaki, of course, is Japanese and in Japan, and he would have had more access to materials on his life. I've only read the English version of Horikoshi's own memoir. It's called Eagles of Mitsubishi. The original Japanese title was Zero-sen, after the fighter plane. And it was translated by the University of Washington in 1980. I read it back when I was in college. According to the preface of the memoir, Horikoshi reviewed the manuscript shortly before his death. So I would presume that it represents the sort of image of himself that he was comfortable with putting out in the public. Horikoshi, I think, died in 1982, a long time ago. There are some vivid images in the memoir that show up in the movie. In The Wind Rises, for example, there's this whole bit about the absurdity of Japan's most advanced fighter planes having to be hauled to their test flights on an ox cart. That really happened. In the book, Horikoshi explains that airstrips, of course, are built on flat land, but flat land was such a premium in Japan that Mitsubishi couldn't do what would be the logical thing and build the factory right next to an airport. On top of that, said Horikoshi, the roads were so bad that it was actually safer to use cattle to haul the plane than putting it in a truck, because the cattle were less likely to overturn, you know, and ruin your plane. When you read Horikoshi's memoir, you could also see how Miyazaki as an anime director might have felt a spiritual kinship to him. Because the way Horikoshi describes the process of making a new plane in the 1930s, it kind of reminds you of making an anime. He had a core staff, all of whom he names, for example, of 30 people, who were split into subsections. one section, for example, work on the wings, another on the gun mounts, another on the landing gear, etc. And Horikoshi notes that literally thousands of different drawings had to go into his design. And he even details how he had to sometimes personally get in there and correct the drawings of his inexperienced assistants. But also, when you read the memoir, while Horikoshi never comes off as especially bloodthirsty or jingoistic, he also never expressed any negativity towards the fact that he was building warplanes. On the contrary, he expressed pride at how he was able to meet and exceed the military specifications, even with Japan's limited resources and industrial base. He also shows great respect for the pilots who tested his planes, some of whom died during the development of the Zero. By contrast, the movie seems to put a kind of spiritual distance between the military who wanted the plane and the plane's designer. There's a scene I remember in the movie where the Navy officers are having a meeting with him at the plant. All of them are portrayed as bellicose and arguing, in contrast to the perfectly calm Horikoshi. And then Miyazaki even puts in the scene where the Japanese secret police start to become suspicious of Horikoshi, and his superiors have to hide him so he can keep on doing his work. When you stop to think about it logically, the work he keeps on doing, of course, is designing a classified fighter plane for the government. So staying on the project while hiding out from his own government security forces doesn't seem like a resolved basic problem. In real life, a lot of people in 1930s Japan who got suspected of anti-war views were brutally oppressed by the secret police. So it seems that one of the choices Miyazaki made in this movie, when he constructs his literary vision of Horikoshi, his fictional Horikoshi, is that his version, far from taking pride in fulfilling specific military objectives, is indifferent to them. And he even is suspected at one point of being an enemy of the state. Likewise, a major element of the film is the romance, his relationship with the woman who later becomes his wife, Naoko. While in real life Horikoshi was married, in his memoir he expresses regret that his dedication to his work meant he couldn't spend more time with his family. Now, in the movie, I think Miyazaki does touch on this concern, but he also constructs things so he does everything to link Horikoshi's love for his wife to his love for aviation. In the movie, both things are carried aloft by the same winds and what they symbolize to the both of them. Just like Miyazaki's film, the real Horikoshi did portray himself as somebody who dreamed of building planes since childhood. You remember that scene at the beginning of the film where he crawls out on the roof and there's this fantastic plane that he gets into and flies. That's also in his memoir. And in his memoir, he portrays himself as somebody who did dedicate himself successfully to that dream. But what the dream meant to the real Horikoshi wasn't quite the same as the movie. In the introduction to his memoir, Horikoshi quotes a naval officer who said that if there was one thing for which foreigners might still respect the people of Japan after the war, it was that they had built the Zero. I was reading last year The Guardian, the newspaper in the UK, was quoting Miyazaki about the film, and he said something comparable. He said the Zero represented one of the few things, quote, we Japanese, unquote, could be proud of. But I also thought about the difference between what that naval officer wrote in the introduction to the memoir and what Miyazaki said. Miyazaki said the Japanese could respect the Zero. The naval officer said foreigners could respect the Japanese for the Zero. Now, that's just one quote from Miyazaki, but it goes without saying that the Zero didn't earn its pride and respect on a drawing board or at air shows. It earned it only one way. It earned it in war. The same Guardian article also quoted Miyazaki as saying that he had, quote, very complex feelings about the war, and that militarist Japan had acted out of, quote, foolish arrogance. But Miyazaki also said the Zero was a, quote, formidable presence, and so were its pilots. And at this point, I think it's reasonable to ask the follow-up question, formidable? Formidable towards whom? And the answer is, of course, the foreigners Japan went to war against, presumably out of that foolish arrogance. But in Miyazaki's movie, the ideas that led to the creation of the Zero can exist somewhere in a state of pure design and dreams. That's presumably how Miyazaki wishes us to think about this guy, Jiro Horikoshi. And that Guardian article that quoted him as saying that Horikoshi, quote, wasn't thinking about weapons. All he really desired was to make exquisite planes. But in his memoir, Horikoshi recalls that when he read in the paper that the planes he made had successfully escorted a Japanese bombing raid on Nanking, he proudly went and he showed the article to his family. Now, the Zero was indeed a formidable presence because even though England and America eventually built planes that could beat it, in its time, it was arguably the most advanced fighter plane in the world. Its pilots also had to be the best because of its unprecedented speed and maneuverability. In fact, another difference between the movie Horikoshi and the real one is that the real person, as an airplane designer, he thought a lot about the needs of the pilot who was going to have to fly it. In the memoir, he recalls the first time he went up in a training plane, and he describes from experience the intense physical and perceptual challenges that confront a fighter pilot, you know, who's moving in every direction at once at high speed. Now, Miyazaki has flown a lot himself, and these are the kind of experiences he would have been very good at subjectively depicting. But again, I got an impression from The Wind Rises of a deliberate spiritual distance placed between the pilots and the designers. And part of the way that comes off in the film is an emphasis on Horikoshi striving for the beautiful, the carefree, the graceful aspects of flight. Whereas the real Horikoshi, again, was designing planes for the chaotic, fast-changing tactical environments. That's the world that fighter pilots operate in. What I take away from all this and what I took away from the movie is that Miyazaki is willing, at least on one level, to acknowledge the difference between the real person and the film version of that person. And also, his quotes in The Guardian make me think that he's willing to at least allude to admitting that he admires more the reality than what he actually put into the film. Maybe the closest spiritual predecessor of The Wind Rises is Miyazaki's 1992 film, Porco Rosso, which also took an anti-militarist view in the context of aviation between the world wars. But it's one thing to make a romantic fable out of Porco Rosso's hero, Marco Bago. He was a fictional character. Jiro Horikoshi was a real person. I think maybe Miyazaki realizes that in the end, he's too much of a romantic and too strong-willed an artist to make a movie that lets Jiro Horikoshi be the person he actually was, even though he has a lot of admiration for the actual person. If he's going to become the hero of a Miyazaki film, that means he's going to have to become a Miyazaki character, which means, among other things, being a character who's anti-war and has no great enthusiasm for the military as an institution. I think that if Miyazaki greatly admires the real Horikoshi, as he has said, and yet, in the movie, makes him into the kind of person he would have ideally liked him to have been, then you might be getting to the point where what we're seeing also is Miyazaki projecting the kind of life he himself would like to have had onto Horikoshi. Even though, like Horikoshi, I don't think Miyazaki would ever have any false modesty about his own brilliance. Let me explain what I mean. You have in The Wind Rises his character, you know, the hero who's a poetic visionary, but he makes his dreams real through dedication to both hard work and theoretical understanding. That's exactly the picture I got of Miyazaki himself from his own memoir, Starting Point. And I don't call it ego or hyperbole, not with Miyazaki, you know, not with what he's accomplished. When you read Starting Point, you realize that it wasn't just Miyazaki's natural talent that made him anime's greatest director. He became so because he kept working at it and thinking about filmmaking for decades. What should I do with my craft? You know, what kind of film should I be making? But the character in the movie is also portrayed as a man whose most important personal relationship in his personal life, it turns out to be in complete spiritual harmony with his work. When they first meet, he and his wife exchange two halves of the same literary quote, The Wind Rises, you know, from which the Paul Valery quote. So they're like secret agents who made contacts with each other. In the movie, the hero's wife is never somebody who has to find herself angry or sad or unfulfilled in their relationships because of his work. In the movie version of this life, their relationship and his work are part of the same shared romantic dream. Naoko says how much she loves to watch him work. There's even the scene where he edges his drawing table as close to her bedside as possible, so she can hold one of his hands, while with the other, he works on his project. I don't think you could find a more wistful vision of a husband and wife who are joined and not separated by the husband's work. And it's also true that the way Miyazaki wrote the film, it's something that can't last. What you see in the movie must be very different, a very different kind of challenge from a real life, where a couple lives together for decades, and one of them happens to be a driven genius. Maybe I thought maybe these desires are also linked to Miyazaki's longtime nostalgia for the idea of the small craft workshop. That's, again, something we saw in Porco Rosso, and come to think of it, we also saw it in his other great flight films, such as Nausicaa and Laputa. He portrays people who literally build their aircraft at home. These anime, they suggest an ideal where work and family never have to become alienated from each other, as opposed to the real-life anime industry, where people sometimes find themselves living at their job to meet production deadlines. And if that was indeed a kind of wish fulfillment for Miyazaki's personal life, I wonder if there wasn't another kind of ideal family relationship he projected onto this character, Jiro Horikoshi, not only to be a certain type of husband, but even a certain type of son. So recently, as I said, there was that whole flap about Miyazaki speaking about the effects of otaku in the anime industry. But he gave the lead role in The Wind Rises to the otaku who's affected anime more than any other, Hideaki Anno, the director of Evangelion. Miyazaki loves Anno. He was the person who gave the speech at his wedding reception. And from one perspective, their relationship might seem odd because Miyazaki is seen correctly as this person who has very strong critical and artistic beliefs about anime. You can't ever imagine Miyazaki making Evangelion. Miyazaki using his great talents to say, oh, I'm going to make something like that. And yet, he entrusted Anno with conveying the character in his final film, ostensibly. Miyazaki has also spoken of tremendous respect for Anno's Studio Kara, talking about the new generation of animators that he's training. Maybe at the end of the day, Miyazaki sees himself in Anno, and that Anno is also a brilliant animator who came out of the Cell era and somebody who was willing to dedicate most of his life, maybe even sometimes to its detriment, you know, to the craft of animation. If there's one thing, you know, you can't doubt about Anno, that he's dedicated, you know, and brilliant as an animator. And maybe, you know, that would be a great kind of son to have, you know, and ideally, you know, somebody who truly is someone who is a visionary in animation. So that made me think as well, you know, did that film in a sense represent the passing, you know, of the torch, you know, to another generation? So when I talk about all this, this all sounds like I'm being very critical of The Wind Rises.
I don't know. I don't think so.
But really what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to articulate some of the differences between history, real life, and Miyazaki's art, so you can take in the full measure of that art. And I would say, if this really is his last film, it's the most audacious movie he's ever made. Miyazaki must be familiar with the career of Mitsuyo Seo. He was the person who made the first feature-length anime film in Japan. In 1943, Seo made an anime movie that, like The Zero itself, was sponsored by the Japanese Navy. It was called Momotaro Sea Eagle. Have you guys seen it?
Nope.
Okay. Well, it was released in English on DVD in 2008 as part of Zaka Film's Roots of Japanese Anime collection. So in this anime, Momotaro Sea Eagle, it was a film made for children. But in it, Momotaro, who is the Peach Boy of Japanese folklore, he's recast as the commanding officer of the Zero pilots who attack Pearl Harbor. And the DVD shows how the film was promoted in Japan during the war. It was promoted as a depiction of nationalist pride, not only in Japan's military pilots and the Zero plane, but in animation itself. They were boasting that Japan was now obliterating American cartoons, the same way it was sinking their battleships. The movie made back more than three times its production budget, and in that new book of Jonathan Clements, he calls it the defining Japanese propaganda cartoon of the war period. That movie's director, Mitsuyo Seo, he lived to be 98. He lived to see every film in Miyazaki's career, except for this last one. Something in The Wind Rises that Miyazaki fictionally applied to Jiro Horikoshi, it actually did happen to Mitsuyo Seo. And that is, he actually was suspected by his government before the war, and reportedly even arrested and tortured. But if he decided to make anime to support the military instead, as he eventually did, he could gain access to unprecedented levels of budget and support that allowed him to realize his dreams of becoming an animator. Like Miyazaki, Mitsuyo Seo had once been a leftist, and when he tried to return to making anime films after the war, he found the new work he was making under democracy was once again considered too left-wing. So his career as an anime director ended at age 38. that's the same age Miyazaki was when he directed his first film. Watching The Wind Rises, I wondered if you can make an illusion that was so powerful that in the end it casts a real shadow. In this fiction of Jiro Horikoshi that Miyazaki creates, I see the shadow of this real person, Mitsuyo Seo. He's an anime director who 70 years ago, he showed Japanese audiences what Horikoshi really made his planes for, and the truth that Horikoshi created his highest art as a military project. So yeah, that was my impression of the film. I was pretty blown away by it. Just cut it to that poll quote, pretty blown away by it.
Yeah, some interesting thoughts, Carl. I'm not sure I have a whole lot to add to that, to be honest.
Well, what did you think, Zach?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, you have? I thought it was... Didn't they have the 1 week showing in L.A.?
Yeah, I didn't get up there for that. It's opening wide, and we just not. I wasn't all that in a huge rush to get out to see it. But hearing your description of it, it sort of solidifies how I kind of felt about the film. Thinking this is what this is. Honestly, man, it sounds like it is engineering fetishism taken to its absolute, like, apex limit, where you are separating ethically and morally what you created. It's like a movie where it romanticizes and idolizes Dr. Frankenstein, and ignores Frankenstein's monster. Like, let's ignore the monster. Let's talk about what a brilliant genius Dr. Frankenstein was. Which is really an issue. And I think it's like, I'm looking forward to seeing it, but the more I hear about it, the engineering fetishism on display sounds like exactly what I was expecting, especially from Miyazaki at this point. I'm very much looking forward to seeing it, but the way you describe it, man, that is exactly what I was expecting.
I don't know if I'd use the term fetishism. You know, you see a lot of World War II, you know, that era fetishism, you know, in anime, you know, Kankoda and things like that. The, you know, there's a long tradition of it. It's sort of, you know, it's beyond that. It's not, you know, fetishism, I think, is kind of a physical thing. It's something like that, but it's more spiritual. It's like...
I get what you're saying,
The idea that you could somehow... refine that if you're a brilliant enough artist, you could somehow take history and pour it through your tubes and beakers and make something purified out of it. You know, not because you're a nationalist. The funny thing is, I could see both left and right wing people getting mad at Miyazaki for this film.
Well, you know? I mean, they have, in fact.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, people on the right and the left in Japan are super pissed off at him because of this.
I think if he were a fetishist, he would say what he can't seem to bring himself to say, and that's the Zero kicked ass. You know, Oshii would say that. Anno would say that. But Miyazaki wouldn't say it. You know, like I said, it doesn't make any sense to say that you should have pride in the Zero. Like, that. The fact he was able to say that sort of tipped me off to the fact that he does understand what the Zero actually was for, that it was a fighter plane. And in terms of the great atrocities of World War II, fighter planes are not all that high up on the list. You know,
we're getting into that. You're getting into some relativism there. It's
relativism. I don't think you can. I don't think relativism is something that, you know, you can't just stop there. Have you read John Dower's book, Cultures of War?
I have not.
Okay. The reason I bring up John Dower is he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Embracing Defeat, which was about occupation era Japan. But he's the person who I found out originally about World War II propaganda anime in Japan. And he was writing about this back in the 1980s. He's an expert on the propaganda of that period. And in doing so, he found out not only about standard things like posters and radio broadcasts, but this whole history of propaganda anime that was financed by the Japanese Navy. So he wrote a book called Cultures of War, in which he talked about how things escalated in World War II, and that things which seemed tremendous atrocities at the time, like you drop a few bombs on a city and that was considered to be the worst thing that had ever happened, then you drop more bombs and you drop more bombs, you know, until eventually you are burning down entire cities and nuking entire cities and it's just part of war. But there is a difference, you know, between killing a few people and killing hundreds of people and killing thousands of people. So when you say relativism, that's kind of difference, like, I want to acknowledge. You know, there's a difference between somebody who, you know, herds people into concentration camps, you know, and somebody who's a soldier, you know, in an army. You can say that they're all part of the same system, but I don't think it helps us understand history, you know, well, if we just, you know, put everything together.
Sure, but ultimately my point is, if you're going to make a movie that talks about, you know, sort of lifts up the genius of this guy, and ultimately what he made is a gun, you have to talk about what the gun did. Like,
exactly. And Miyazaki solves that problem by pretending he didn't care about guns. And, you know, he simply rewrites the guy. And again, he acknowledges this is a fictional version of him. But I don't know, maybe there is some merit to getting both the left and the right mad at you. You sure. know, but I guess, that's why I called it audacious. You know, if you want to accept this film, you have to accept it as the artist, you know, being supreme above everything, including history, including the facts. You don't have to accept that point of view. You can say, I don't buy it. You need to acknowledge what this guy actually was doing. And again, like, he wasn't a monster or anything. I don't think so. It's just that he was a different person than the person Miyazaki is portraying. He was somebody who had no problem at all with the fact that he was designing planes for the military, and that's what he worked towards. You know, you talked about gun, and yeah, the Zero is basically a gun platform, and he thought, what does it need? It needs stability. It needs maneuverability. This whole idea that he basically wanted to make these beautiful gliders that soar through the sky, that wasn't the real guy at all, and that wasn't his real work at all. It's a fascinating thing, especially since, if I understand correctly, Miyazaki's own family were subcontractors for the Zero. Miyazaki's family comes out of the aviation industry. He was born in 1941 during the war, and that was how he got his early exposure, you know, to the technology of aviation. You know, he was intimately involved with it. So it becomes an even more personal film in that respect. It's astonishing. If I'm not mistaken, this is Miyazaki's only film about an actual person, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So there's no, nothing really to compare it to. It's like, so this is what happens when he makes a film that's semi-biographical, and it turns out that, you know, it's sort of a fantasy film. That's kind of fascinating. I actually want him to make more movies now, so we can, you know, see where he's going to go from here.
Yeah, Carl, you mentioned that, you know, he acknowledges, you know, that this is not really, you know, the same Horikoshi that actually existed. But my, you know, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I had no idea whatsoever that this was not in any, you know, like, I didn't realize it was that much a fantasy and, you know, that much a rewriting of this guy's life. Where has Miyazaki kind of acknowledged that? I'm curious. Is it just in the film, or has he, I mean, because just reading the stuff about it, I had no idea.
As I said, my thought that he was acknowledging it was the fact that at the end of the film, he, if I recall correctly, because I wasn't taking notes, he dedicates the film to Horikoshi and also to Hori, who wrote the novel The Wind Rises, where he gets the romance plot from. So the fact that he was dedicating it to the real person, but also to the person who wrote this fiction, that, you know, and I may be misinterpreting it, that might just be sort of one way of sort of, you know, tipping his hat and saying, yeah, I'm talking about this. It's dedicated to the person and also to this person who wrote fiction. Miyazaki has made statements which suggests that he, you know, is, again, the fact that he thinks people should respect the Zero and all that. A statement, again, which I said has no meaning in the real world unless you respect its performance as a war machine, which is what everybody respects it for. That's how it earned its reputation. You know, I mean, you don't have to respect weapons of war at all. You don't have to respect, you know, military things at all. But if you do respect the Zero, that's what it's for. It's like respecting a 747 that, like, never flew anybody across the ocean. You know, it's like, that's what it's designed for. It's, you know, it's a big passenger plane. The movie is this kind of, and I realize one thing people might say is, well, he wasn't really talking about the Zero because they don't get that far in the film. The movie doesn't quite get to that point. Instead, they talk about his theoretical models that went up to it. But if you read Horikoshi's memoir, his entire professional career was, before the war, was building planes to the Navy and to military specifications. There was never a time when he was a civilian, you know, plane designer. So, again, I'm just kind of astonished. And I'm curious as to his motivations. He says, you know, he quotes Horikoshi from somewhere saying that all I wanted to do was make something beautiful. I haven't run across that quote, but maybe he's really, maybe that's really expressing his own feelings. Like, all Miyazaki wanted to do was to make something beautiful, which is what he's doing, but it's not what happened. You know, it's not the reality of the person. It's not, you know, the reality of the times. And I wonder how many people in Japan are aware of this. Like, you know, the Second World War is a long time ago. You know, the people who fought in it are quite elderly now. And, you know, even people who consider themselves nationalist or right wing may not always be aware of the facts, or they may have their own set of facts. So, academics, I think maybe they're getting out of this habit, but there used to be this cliche that academics related everything. Whenever they'd look at anime, they'd say, oh, this reflects the fear of the atom bomb. This reflects, you know, World War II and all that. And, you know,
that's still true.
Japanese person doesn't spend much time thinking about World War II or the atom bomb. And I guess a lot of people in the audience, you know, and Miyazaki makes his films for mass audiences and mainstream audiences, probably only a small percentage of them actually remember the war. As time, you know, memories get fade and they get overwritten by other memories and other interpretations. So I wonder if that aspect of the film is at all controversial. It seems the controversies that have been reported, at least that have gotten to the English language media, seem kind of superficial. Like, they're saying, it's controversial because this guy did the Zero. But they're not getting into it, sort of saying, to me, the larger controversy is his approach to the art, you know, his approach to the story, saying that, yes, it's the guy who did the Zero, but he's not that guy in the film, even though that's the guy who Miyazaki said he respects. That makes an even more interesting tension, in my opinion, and that's where the artistry of the film comes in. You don't have to accept it as valid. You can say, I don't buy it, you know, it's not the way to do it, he shouldn't have done it, you know, he's making this valueless, you know. But I think it is kind of a bold statement. I don't know if it represents, like, all of the accumulated confidence that he's developed, you know, over his career, or if it really is his last film. Maybe he just doesn't give a damn, you know, what people think about it. But it certainly, in my opinion, is going out on a, you know, something to think about. I was a little surprised that it got nominated for an Oscar, not because I don't think it deserves it, but, you know, the content, you know, is rather interesting. It's, I think, definitely an adult film. And, you know, the movies which are nominated for the best animated category are usually things that are suitable, you know, for the whole family. Miyazaki, of course, also exposed the truth about smoking in Japan, which is, you know.
Well, one of the scary things I think about that movie is that even with the argument for artistry is that you have to look at a broader spectrum and just the degree of rewriting that goes on within Japan and the amount of debate over that now, especially like on an international level between Korea and Japan and China and Japan. And that even if Miyazaki didn't have an inherently revisionist mindset going into it, it still kind of fits into those other issues that still linger in Asia over World War II. And there's kind of a danger to that when, I mean, obviously you can say, look at the memoirs of this guy or whatever, but ultimately more people are going to be seeing that movie and that will reach a far broader spectrum than anyone than any other sort of greater viewpoint.
I wonder what the reaction to this film has been in China and Korea, if it's been in commercial release there yet.
I have no idea, but I cannot imagine it would go over too well there. I don't know. Carl, I wanted to ask before we move on here, and we got to move on. I did want to know if you had read the two essays on this film over at Badass Digest by Devin Faraci and Film Crit Hulk thought it was the best movie he saw last year, and Devin Faraci was deeply troubled by it and had a really hard time writing about it. And I thought those two essays provided a really perfect encapsulation of the potential American response to a film, to that particular film.
I haven't read them yet. I've heard a little bit about them. They sound like they're really worthwhile.
Yeah.
And they sound also like two perfectly legitimate points of view on this film.
Yeah. I think from an American point of view, like, I know everybody tries to be, you know, super open-minded and stuff like that. But, you know, we're looking at this film about the guy who created something that specifically killed thousands of Americans. So you got, I don't think it's closed-minded to not be able to divorce those things in your head. I really don't. I'm looking forward to seeing the film myself, but right now my attitude is, like, I totally understand why people would be really conflicted by this movie, especially an American audience, because you're looking at a guy that created a weapon of war specifically to kill Americans, and did so very successfully. I think it's a touchy thing. Like I said, I'm also surprised that it was nominated for an Oscar, but that must speak to the power of the film itself.
Actually, I think it was made specifically to kill Chinese more than Americans.
Okay, well,
yeah, no, it's that's a, you know, we naturally see remember the war with Japan in terms of things like Pearl, starting at Pearl Harbor and ending with, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Right.
The war, and this is Miyazaki does acknowledge this in the film. The war was already going on, in the beginning of the 1930s, was going on in China. Most of the people who actually died in the in that part of the world during the war were Chinese. And it's sometimes convenient in Japan, and you can sometimes tell what side people are on politically by how they remember the war. The people who prefer to remember the war as being with America, in some sense, that was a cleaner war, more romantic. You know, you have the Yamato sailing forth. You have Admiral Yamamoto and all of his, you know, brilliant ships. You know, the Navy didn't commit nearly as many atrocities.
Sure.
Or there's the other side of the war, which is the dirty war that was fought, you know, in China and Korea and the Philippines, you know, the ground war, you know, the war of, you know, of massive atrocities. But they're both sides of the same war. I was totally flipping because there's a character in the film who is a reference to Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain. He's a German character, Kotzorb. And do you know who's going to play him in the dub?
Werner Herzog.
Yes. I love to think, I'm not sure this is true, but I would love for it to be true that Miyazaki saw him in the Boondocks and said, get me that guy. Sorry.
I know Zach wants to move on, but I want to talk about, like, one final note. Something you touched on, Carl, is really interesting is how there's been this story the last few days that Miyazaki doesn't like otaku, blah, blah, blah. And I think it was interesting that he portrayed a character in this film that is, I'm kind of like, this is obviously before otaku, but he fits so many of those kind of stereotypes of an otaku, yeah. He doesn't really care about the moral consequences of what he's doing. He just cares about if A fits into B the best way and how can he make the curves the best and all this. It's very mathematical, right? I thought it was so interesting that this character is so precise, and in the film, his friends say, "Oh, this dude's not normal. He doesn't care about going out and socializing. Whenever he just cares about planes." And I thought it's interesting that Miyazaki has such respect for this guy, who feels like a pre-anime otaku, when he himself is criticized Otaku so much.
Yeah, I mean, that fits into what Carl also mentioned about, you know, why would you cast Anno at the lead role, you know? Like, that seriously was the first thing that popped in my head. I still don't really, I vaguely understand where it's coming from, but still.
I think also there's a difference between, there are different kinds of otaku. Anno and Horikoshi, as he portrays them, they're otaku who do something. In other words, they use their obsessive nature to actually make something, be it a film or a plane. There's also the otaku who just collects stuff, you know, and sits back and watches stuff. So I think Miyazaki can have respect for the otaku who uses their obsessive nature to actually, you know, craft something and build something.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. The other interesting thing about his casting of Anno is how jarring it is. I mean, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, Carl, but for the first half hour or so, just hearing his voice versus all the other characters in the film who are voiced by professional voice actors, just the dissonance between those performances was just, it took a while to kind of sink in.
I think I got used to it a bit quicker, you know, maybe after the first 5 minutes. After that, I was okay. I sometimes like it in anime when they have unconventional, you know, casting.
Yeah.
Especially since, you know, anime voice acting can be very charming, but, you know, also, of course, it's sort of, oh, we want to get that kind of voice, you know?
Right. I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I agree with you. It was just that the rest of the voices in that film do feel like that kind of more conventional anime voice acting thing, whereas his didn't, and it felt like a real disconnect.
Maybe he wanted to set, you know, as you said, this is a obsessive character, you know, a driven character who's not like, you know, pretty much anyone else. You know, perhaps that was part of the process.
Yeah, totally. I felt kind of disappointed by the American casting, which is far more, you know, I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I think he's a fine actor, but I wish they had gone a little bit more interesting on that.
Oh, so you haven't seen Don John then?
Okay, fair enough. No. He's a cool guy. He makes interesting films. I just don't think he's got that same. And the, you know, Anno's what, in his 50s, and.
Oh no, it's a bad casting choice. Can't imagine. Well, I mean, maybe it'll work. Who knows? I haven't seen it.
That raises an interesting question. Who would you suggest as an American person who could convey Anno?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, like, Werner Herzog, I think, is such a cool casting choice because he's a multi-talented guy, like Anno is, I guess, you know, actor, director. But Joseph Gordon-Levitt has made films, too. I don't know. He feels a little... I mean, there was a quote from Miyazaki that said one of the reasons he cast Anno is he's got that kind of sorrow in his voice, right? Which I don't think of at all with Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah, that's sort of the opposite, actually.
Yeah.
okay, so that was great. I you've got me even more intrigued to see this thing than I was before. But ostensibly, we were here to talk about the anniversary of Royal Space Force: Wings of Onyamas, also known as Star Quest.
Yeah, that was a great film, Star Quest. I don't know about that Royal Space Force stuff, but Star Quest was awesome.
Which you published a fanzine about last year, which was a big anniversary for the film, and I guess the idea was to talk about that movie and talk about sort of what its significance now and its relevance now. So I guess take it away, Carl.
Well, to start off a little perspective, I've seen the new Evangelion movie 3.0 twice now. Mm-hmm. And the plot might be difficult to understand, but the original Evangelion didn't exactly have a crystal clear plot either. Where I thought the movie showed growth as an Evangelion story was in some of the characters. And in my case, the characters who grew were the ones who sort of went away from this apocalyptic mindset. One of those characters is a big surprise to me. So I can recommend this new Evangelion movie to an Evangelion fan. But watching it, I also thought of something else. 3.0 came out in Japan in 2012. It was 25 years after Gainax's first film, Royal Space Force, did. And the two movies share some of the same top creative people. Shinji Higuchi is in it, Yoshiyuki Sadamoto, Mahiro Maeda, and of course, Hideaki Anno. But I couldn't say that even though 25 years have gone by, 3.0 was a better film than Royal Space Force, that it's a better movie than what Anno was making with Gainax 25 years ago. There's no doubt the two films are very different in mood and style and intent. But when I say better film overall, I mean taking everything into account you'd consider when evaluating a movie. Visuals, direction, characters, concept, script. If you're okay with Evangelion 3.0, despite how strange a film it is, you certainly shouldn't be afraid to look into Royal Space Force as a alternate creative vision of what Gainax can be and, in fact, have been. So the other people on the show, you know, who I'm very happy to be here are Colony Drop. And one of the ways they come into it is not too long ago, they published the first of their fanzines through HP's MagCloud service, which is an online print-on-demand service. Their zine had some great articles in it. It looked great. It was very nicely designed. It kind of stood as a statement about what's cool about actual print. And fans can now access that print quality, which used to only be available to professional publishers. So Colony Drop's fanzine inspired me to help put together a zine on Gainax's movie Royal Space Force. The movie had been out of print for a while in North America, but it got re-released last year on DVD and Blu-ray by Sentai. Because Gainax has been known to work collectively to make their anime, I wanted to take the same approach to the fanzine and invite various different people to write it. So for the Royal Space Force fanzine, there's articles in it by Gerald Rathkolb of Anime World Order, who, of course, was just recently on ANNcast. Another person you've had on the show that wrote for the fanzine was Tim Mon. I asked him in particular because not only he's an anime fan, but he's also a professional science fiction author. And I thought that'd be a good insight to have on what can certainly be considered a science fiction film. Two of the other contributors to the Royal Space Force scene were longtime columnists on ANN, Aaron Finnegan, who used to do Shelf Life, and Brian Hansen, who used to be Answer Man. The fifth person who ended up giving the zine a kind of special perspective was Wild Arms Hero of the site Analog Hoso. And I think he also did a cartoon in the latest Colony Drop zine. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Yeah, he did one in both.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. But what made him special was that he was the only person writing for the zine who'd never seen the movie before. In fact, he wasn't even born when the movie came out. And as we say in the introduction to the zine, Gainax didn't make this movie out of nostalgia for the past, despite its retro appearance. So I didn't want the zine to be dominated by that vibe either. And I think if Royal Space Force is truly a movie that belongs to the past, there's not much point in seeing it, much less talking about it. The occasion of us doing the zine was, okay, it was the 25th anniversary of Royal Space Force. But the idea behind the zine, do you remember the first episode of Bakano?
I do.
Okay. So yeah. In the first episode, they're having that conversation about how are we going to tell this story? You know, there's all this cast of people and all these crazy things happened. We could tell the story from different perspectives. It's sort of how we choose it. And I thought about the history of anime is certainly like that too. The zine says Royal Space Force on the cover, and it talks a lot about Royal Space Force and gives a lot of information about it. But it's also one way of looking back on the last 30 years of anime through this perspective. Gainax is not a big or wealthy studio compared to, say, Ghibli or Toei, but they've had an important influence on modern anime. And the thing about Gainax is they were literally created to make this movie, Royal Space Force. That's what brought them all together. So there are many valid paths you could draw to explain where anime has been and where it's gone. I thought that one of them would be to sort of look at this as a case study, the case of Gainax and its first production. Now, people sometimes struggle to understand Royal Space Force as a Gainax work because it has few or none of the things we've come to associate with Gainax. It has no cute characters. It has no fan service. It has no in-jokes from other anime. Now, people have to latch onto something to explain how it's a Gainax work. I mean, the same people who made Gunbuster and Evangelion made this. So what they often focus on, quite understandably, is the plot about putting the first man to space. So people might say, oh, this movie represents the tastes of otaku of a previous generation. Science fiction and space travel were more important to them. Oh, I get it now. It's fan service for space exploration fans. But as we explain in the zine, that wasn't the intention of Gainax either. Yeah, the struggle to put the first human into space, that's the narrative of Royal Space Force. Just like the narrative of Evangelion is about the Ava units fighting the angels. But you wouldn't say Evangelion was about the Ava units fighting the angels. If the intent of the movie, if the intent of Royal Space Force had been simply to idealize the space program, to make this sort of stirring tribute, you know, to the idea of human beings going to space, it wouldn't have put the whole thing into such a realistic social and political context as it does. And especially if the movie was trying to insist that you see its main character as a hero just because he happens to be an astronaut, it wouldn't have shown him as a person who's also capable of being a villain. So that was sort of my starting point, you know, for this. The Colony Trop guys, you read the zine, didn't you?
Yep.
I guess, I don't know. I mean, what were your perceptions going into the film?
Well, I thought one thing that was interesting specifically from the zine itself was you transcribed part of an interview with Yamaga and some of the other guys behind Royal Space Force that I think came out around the same time that the movie came out. And it features Yamaga criticizing otaku culture and the otaku mindset in a lot of the same way that people might be criticizing it today, to the point where parts of the interview almost feel like they could have been written today as much as they were in 1987. And I think it's interesting that those same kind of criticisms have existed for that long, but it's also interesting when you consider where Gainax ended up and kind of that 180 that they took after Royal Space Force and started doing really hardcore fan-oriented stuff like Gunbuster and then eventually Evangelion and things like that.
Yeah, Gainax has been making anime for 30 years now, and people have different, you know, people have different eras of Gainax things they're fans of. You know, people might be fans of Gurren Lagann or Panty and Stocking with Garter Belt. Earlier era might have been fans of things like Mahoromatic or things like Furikuri or Evangelion. You can go back and back. And people also have different theories about when Gainax made a big switch or big change or fell off or whatever. But in the zine, we argue the most dramatic switch that Gainax ever made was between their first and their second works, between Royal Space Force and Gunbuster. Something that pretty much probably everyone listening to this podcast has seen is the Daikon 4 opening anime. That's extremely famous even today. It's set to ELO's song Twilight. It's got the iconic bunny girl surfing on the sword, you know, and flying through this whole wonderland of like otaku culture. The person who directed that was the same person who directed Royal Space Force. And the two things are nothing alike. He saw the Daikon opening films for what they were. These were fan videos. They were made for fans, by fans. They were literally the films that were opening fan conventions. That wasn't the sort of thing he thought he should necessarily make as a professional. Yamaga was concerned that if you go into the anime industry as a professional and all you end up doing is making slicker versions, higher budget versions of what you're doing as a fan, then have you really gone anywhere? Like, what was the point of going into anime then? People present a lot of dichotomies and oppositions in anime. And one thing that you might have, for example, is say, oh, anime is too dominated by cute girls versus I wish there were more anime about mecha. But in the introductory proposal for Royal Space Force that got the film greenlit, Yamaga and also Toshio Okada, at the time the president of Gainax, they saw those as different sides of the same thing. They ultimately were both in danger of being fetishized. You look at anime at the time like Macross, where you have all these cute girls and all these, you know, gleaming mecha. And fans will say, you know, fans were saying, but anime is becoming so sophisticated in storytelling. You know, look at these story arcs. It's developed, you know, through these dozens of episodes, and it's got all this realism, you know, this real-world politics and all that. And Yamaga and Okada were saying, but yeah, you notice you still have the cute girls, who in real life would never be on a ship's bridge. And you still have these highly polished, you know, mecha that are suitable, you know, for selling toys and all that. So you have to acknowledge that. You have to ask yourself, what's really driving these shows? You call them sophisticated, but are they? You know, or are they really in debt, you know, to certain, you know, fetishized things? And they were also reacting against things like Nausicaa. One of the main characters in the film, Rikuni, in Royal Space Force, she was sort of their idea of what Nausicaa would be like in the real world. That is to say, if you took a character like Nausicaa, who really was a peaceful type and that was ideals, but take away everything that Nausicaa is, take away her being beautiful, take away her being a princess, take away her being a jet pilot, take away, you know, all these, you know, cool things, and just put her on a street now with nothing left for her ideals. How is she going to, you know, get by? How is she going to do it? It's going to be rough. So they weren't, you know, they weren't mocking a character with ideals. They were saying that in the real world, though, it's a lot harder to realize those ideals. Royal Space Force was actually about something which often gets associated with Evangelion, and it's about the flight away from reality. Even back in the 80s, Gainax was talking about how, you know, this is even before the internet, that people were being pushed out of reality because there was so much mass media. You know, there's so many ways to escape. Royal Space Force was designed as an anti-escapist anime. It develops this whole, probably the most complex world that has ever been designed on screen, but they didn't do it out of the sake of obsessive detail. They did it to the sake of sort of suggesting that the world has more detail than you realize. There's a great scene in the film where Shiro shows up to meet some of his friends who are going off on a trip, and he's at a train station, and some of the characters who are going by are out of focus. But there's a very strong sense that these are real people too. We don't know their names. We don't know who they are. They're just, you know, doing walk-ons. And yet they're part of this reality. And that Shiro, the ostensible hero, he's just one part of it. They sort of wanted to use... Royal Space Force kind of gets the question of, what does it mean for an otaku to try to make art? And one way is to use your abilities as an otaku, use your ability to obsess and to make fine detail and to work, you know, with great vigor, but see it from the outside, see it from a different perspective. Step away from it for a moment. And basically sort of create a world in which you can start to see yourself. The fact that Shiro is an astronaut, Yamaga has said, you know, he could have been a baker. And at one point, you know, in the film, they actually make a joke. He's thinking about quitting the Space Force and going to work for a bakery. Astronaut provides for a more dramatic narrative. But the purpose of the film was not to celebrate human beings going to space. As he talks to Miyazaki in the zine, it was more about the worthiness and the effort. And to realize that it's all right to have ideals, but it's going to be difficult to change the world with them. There's a large section of the zine involves a conversation between Hayao Miyazaki and Hiroyuki Yamaga that was conducted back in early 1987. Miyazaki was almost literally the first person to see the film, and he thought it was a great film. He really loved it, and he thought it was, you know, going to inspire a new generation of people. But one of the things that Miyazaki did not – there were two things Miyazaki didn't like about the film, and one of them was he didn't – by the fact that it would be the young people in the Space Force who would have to rally the older generation to do things, you know, to say, let's not give up at the end. And Miyazaki was saying, you know, those guys had worked so long on this, they would have never given up. And Yamaga said the resolution to that is that neither one of them are correct. That, yes, it's a film about putting the first person to space, but the movie shows he didn't go into space for either of their reasons. He didn't go into space because they cared about science. He didn't go into space because they cared about engineering. He didn't go into space because of peace or ideals. He went into space because the government thought it'd be a good idea to sort of get a political edge and maybe have a pretense to start a war with another country. In other words, he went into space for the exact same reasons that people went into space in real life, in America and in Russia, for political reasons, you know, for reasons of international rivalry. when the movie first came out, it was a kind of intense time in the U.S. in terms of space, because the Challenger had just blown up, the Space Shuttle Challenger. And that was the first time astronauts had died before in America, but they had died on the ground in training. This is the first time a space mission actually blown up on television in front of everyone's eyes. And so when the movie came out, naturally, American fans and audiences were thinking, oh, this is a statement about, you know, it's really a movie about space and how we've got to go on. And isn't it ironic? This movie shows a world where people don't really care about space and it's all a political thing. But years later, you realize the film was actually talking about the worlds that actually exist. No, most people don't care about space. No, it is a yes, it is a political thing. I mean, if you really think people care about space, then why is NASA always struggling for budget, you know, while the Pentagon has all the money it needs? You know, I don't think even there's any military value to putting people into space. If there was, there'd certainly be, you know, military astronauts up there. So the truth is, people really don't care that much about space. And it's okay to care about it. It's okay to work towards it. It's okay to dream it. But you have to understand that you're going to have to do it in the real world. And that's, in a way, I think this film has more to say about space travel than movies like, say, Apollo 13 or TV shows like From the Earth to the Moon, which are very much openly pro-space works. I say that Real Space Force is a quote-unquote pro-space film, but only in the same sense that Grave of the Fireflies is a quote-unquote anti-war film. There's a great interview that appeared in Animage in 1987 where Isao Takahata, the director of Grave of the Fireflies, is talking with the person who wrote the book that Grave of the Fireflies is based on. And he's sort of giving him his instructions to the film. He's saying, you know, the author was saying, I hate anti-war films. I hate movies where, like, they have people suffer just to get a sentimental rise at the audience. His story, Grave of the Fireflies, was about himself and his sister and their struggle in the war. But it was about actual people. It was about these two particular people. And the reason you should care about them is because these people were real. They really existed. Not because they were in a war. They didn't even have to die. You know, their death didn't happen just because of the war. It happened because of a complex mixture of other things, you know, including their family, their relatives, and, you know, their own mistakes as children. But the idea of Grave of the Fireflies was bring these ghosts back to life by seeing them as the human beings they once were. See them as the individual people they were, even though they were children. Anti-war just, it's not a pro-war film, but, you know, anti-war just keeps you with the tragedy of war itself in that it erases people. It makes them into millions and millions, and they're all individual beings. You know, it's hard. If it's bad enough to kill one person, it's certainly terrible to kill millions of them, and that's why war is bad. But, you know, when you get to those level of abstraction, I think it's difficult to make a good artistic film, you know, about war. You've got to focus on individual people. And so likewise, Royal Space Force is not a film about the space program per se. It's about these people in this movie who make these individual choices. And a space program that happens for reasons that are different from what they actually believe in. But nevertheless, the movie, I believe, respects these characters and respects, you know, the kind of people they are, but wants to be realistic about them. And that you have to open your eyes to the world. And part of opening your eyes to the world is opening your eyes to good and evil, which is not something that exists, you know, just on the outside. The protagonist of the film, Shiro, he starts off as being somebody who just sort of is a slacker, goes through life, doesn't think about things much. And through his relationship with the woman who inspires him to volunteer for space, he starts becoming aware of the oppression in society, the inequality in society. But when he sees that evil, he sees it outside of himself, like, oh, the world is corrupt, but hey, I've woken up to it now. He doesn't realize until it's too late that that evil world is made up of evil people, and maybe he's one of them. Maybe he could be a villain too. You know, he only thinks he's good, but, you know, you can't go through life thinking that, because then you'll find yourself able to commit evil, you know, without knowing it. The most, you know, notorious scene in the film, of course, is where he assaults Requini. And it would be an evil act done towards anybody. But in addition to the assault, it also seems like a betrayal, because this is the person, this is the very person who inspired him. Without her, he never volunteers to go into space. There's no space program. And this is one of the ways to understand that scene. He betrayed the very thing that is driving the entire movie. This very strange, irrational person. And to compare to Nausicaa again, it would have been pretty easy for Yamaga to have Laquini's religion believe in space travel. If you look interestingly at the scripture she reads, there's nothing in there about voyages to the stars. You know how at the end of Nausicaa of the Wind, Nausicaa standing in the field, the Omu are raising her up, and it looks like a golden field. And, oh, the prophecy has been fulfilled, the prophecy of the person in blue, you know, is walking in the golden field. Royal Space Force isn't that kind of movie. You know, there is religion in it, but it's nothing but people's faith. In other words, religion is only as strong as what people believe and the strength that belief gives them. So there isn't even anything about space travel in Riquini's ideas. This seems to be coming from her own belief and her own ideas about, you know, who Shiro is, which in fact, you know, turn out to be somewhat mistaken. The movie is not just a coming-of-age story about him. It's also a coming-of-age story about her. And in the director's commentary for the DVD, Takami Akai, one of the assistant directors in the film, talks about how you can say that they perhaps change places at the end of the film, that Shiro started off as somebody who didn't believe in this, and then now he's a believer, whereas Riquini started off as somebody who did believe in it, and now she's saying, this wasn't what I thought it was. You know, this guy wasn't who I thought he was. You know, he may not be an evil person, but, you know, this is not going to fulfill, you know, ideas and dreams and so forth. And yet this kind of, this weird relationship between these two kind of, you know, lonely people is what creates the entire film. Again, like that's, without that relationship, there is no space program. You know, he doesn't volunteer. So I think that's, you know, rather fascinating. Whereas most anime, you know, struggle to give you characters, I think Royal Space Force does a better job of giving you human beings. You know, people who are difficult to figure out, but who I think insist nevertheless on their own personhood, on their own individuality. And you sort of zoom in on the private lives of these people, including in their worst moments as people. And you realize that's part of life as well, you know. So to relate that back to Evangelion, we Evangelion fans, I'm a big Evangelion fan. You know, I'm the editor of the Evangelion manga and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We have a reputation for being, for, you know, over-intellectualizing something and, like, you know, we really analyze things. There's a whole site, you know, Ava Geeks, and you'll find these massive threads, you know, looking into fine details of the film, find details of the television series, and trying to interpret that. But Royal Space Force does something that's rather radical that most anime never dare try. Think for this about a moment. Evangelion and Royal Space Force had the exact same character designer, Yoshiyuki Sadamoto. But the characters in Royal Space Force do not look very glamorous. They don't look very cute. You're not going to sell figurines, you know, based off of them. So what if you took Shinji? What if you took Riquini? What if you took Shiro? In other words, what if you took the approach that Sadamoto took on Royal Space Force and applied it to Evangelion? In other words, take these characters who we're all really fascinated by, Asuka, you know, Ayanami Rei, Shinji, and make them look more like the characters did in Royal Space Force. You know, make Rei look kind of mousy like Laquini is. You know, make Shinji look kind of like a lunk like Shiro is. You know, make Asuka look like Gainax's original redheaded stepchild, you know, Mana. And I wonder how much into Evangelion we'd be then. You know, in other words, we say, yes, these are deep characters, you know. Yes, these characters are really intense and all that. But they're also, you know, they're very glamorous characters. You know, they're very hot characters. They're very cute characters. So how much of that are we actually talking about their character? And how much are we talking, you know, about their image? And while there's nothing wrong with having, you know, glamorous and hot characters, Where Gainax become artists as otaku is when they step away for a moment and acknowledge what they're doing, when they see what they're doing, when they realize what they're doing. Evangelion became art when it acknowledged that it was only an anime, which was very controversial. When he, you know, showed you the script, when he deconstructed it, when he turned the camera around the movie and showed you the audience, you know, watching it. And you're not supposed to do that. Anime is supposed to be a escapist medium. But in my opinion, because our medium is so based on reality, that makes a much higher demand for us to have self-knowledge, to understand what we're doing, how we're using this. If we want anime to be art, it doesn't have to be art all the time. It's fine for anime just to be entertaining and fun. But you look at season after season of anime, and you'll say, well, anime's doing okay. Anime's fine. Anime's not in any trouble. And that's true. Anime's always never in any trouble. Anime's always fine. And yet there's this nagging sense that some people get that it's always fine, that there should be some other level it gets up to and stays up to. Whereas it's more like you get these occasional works and it's like scrabbling up a slope and you hold on for like one show or one season, and you slide back again and you say, oh, well, maybe next year there'll be another, you know, thing like that. Why should it have to be like that? You know, why can't it, you know, make that step, you know, permanently? And you don't have to compare anime to Western films for this. A comparison I make anime to is to manga. In Japan, manga is much more diversified in terms of its audiences than anime is. And from an American standpoint, you know, if comic books can do that, you know, why can't animation? What I mean is you have these seinen magazines in Japan. You have these magazines like Morning or Big Comic, where if you're 40 years old and you're not an otaku, you can still find something that's going to appeal to you. You can still find something that's interesting. Naturally, even in Japan, the biggest manga of all are the, you know, the shonen titles, you know, Shonen Jump and all that. But the thing is, there is this accepted sort of permanent place for to take it to that other level. I discovered anime when I was 11 years old, and I'm really glad I saw it as a teenager. I think anime has these great things for teenagers that, you know, you're not going to get from like American television. And it probably, you know, says things that, you know, American shows, you know, wouldn't be allowed to or wouldn't dare. But, you know, we're not going to be teenagers forever. It's like, what kind of medium has to put all of its emphasis on teenage characters? Can you really say that medium has evolved? You know, what you need is not to get rid of like shows for teenagers. You need a fully diversified, you know, demographic. You need all these different levels. The protagonist of Royal Space Force is 21. If I'm not mistaken, that's the oldest. Is that the oldest a Gainax protagonist has ever been? I don't know. Some of the characters, it's hard to tell. But, you know, he's definitely no longer a student. You know, he's an experienced adult, but he's definitely an adult. You know, he's out there on his own. And Gainax made this more than 25 years ago. That should have been a starting point. You know, regardless of what people think about the actual film, and it was the first, you know, a first-time director, and Yamaga has said that there are scenes definitely that he would go back, you know, and reshoot. That's not uncommon for any director, you know, to say that. Regardless of all that, it was an amazing beginning, and I think it's a beginning that should go somewhere. That's what I said earlier about, if this is a film that just belongs to the past, then forget about it. Like, forget about it. Don't, seeing Royal Space Force because it's a quote-unquote classic of anime, that's not even the best reason to see it. The reason to see it is to say, is this, I didn't know anime could do this. I didn't know an anime film could be like this. Maybe we should go back to the starting point and do something again like this. When people do tributes to Gainax, they do tributes to like Daikon 4 and all that. But again, that was their fan work. That wasn't what they wanted to be as pros. For various complex reasons, which we get into in the fanzine, Royal Space Force did not work out. But unusually for Gainax, it wasn't their fault. And I want people to sort of, again, I mentioned the youngest contributor to the zine, Wild Arms Hero, was not even born when the film came out. And the movie wasn't really his cup of tea, even though he likes a lot of 80s anime. But he said something in the zine that really struck me. He said, in some ways, this movie is more honest about what it means to be young than most anime are today. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, that's it right there. There is something about this movie that can last. And once you start to get past the idea, again, that this is some sort of movie that fetishizes space travel or something, or, you know, represents the earlier generation of model building otaku, those things are not true. Gainax did, you know, idealize space travel, but they were able to see in this movie, they were able to see their own fetishes as otaku and to, you know, to put them aside, to look at things, you know, from a different angle and be filmmakers, and to use their abilities as otaku as filmmakers. I don't think you have to stop being an otaku in order to be an artist. I think that what you need is you need what every artist needs. You need perspective. You need awareness of self. You need self-knowledge. You know, when you wonder if you see anime as only something to escape into, I think you're also, you know, escaping from yourself necessarily. You know, it's not the flatness of the anime we have to worry about. It's our flatness. Our flatness as an audience. The flatness of our expectations. You know, it's a film that represents ambitions which Miyazaki himself recognized. And this movie came out at a time when Miyazaki was not the big, you know, success he is today. One of the things we get into in the zine is Miyazaki was originally an otaku's filmmaker. He was originally somebody who only otaku would go see his films. It took him a long time to come up and become a mainstream success. Have you guys seen Otaku no Video?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is something that anybody who's an anime fan should check out. You can buy it from Animego. It's only $7.99. They sell it on DVD. But Royal Space Force is the work that really made – I mean, not Royal Space Force. Otaku no Video is really the work that made me a Gainax fan, because it was the work that made me sort of conscious of Gainax as a studio. I never actually thought of Gainax per se in watching Royal Space Force. It just didn't click to me that, oh, there was a studio with this identity. So Otaku no Video is half anime and it's half live action. The anime portions were written by the same person who wrote Royal Space Force, Hiroyuki Yamaga. The live action portions were shot by Higuchi Shinji and had sets made up by Hideaki Anno. So it was, you know, very much a Gainax production. The anime is about this sort of mockumentary version of Gainax's rise, a story about an idealistic young otaku who sort of rises to the top of the industry. Whereas the live-action versions are these very blunt, negative versions of actual otaku. They're interviews with otaku, and they're all like, it's all like they're criminals. Their faces are blurred out, their voices are altered. And at the time, there was a real moral panic in Japan against otaku. When they released this video, Otaku no Video, in 1991, there was zero, you know, commercial appeal to calling something Otaku no Video. It was rather daring to do that. The anime version of it seems to be this very idealistic, but there's actually a sting in it. Because in the anime version of Gainax's life, the thing that makes him a success is an anime called Super Idol Misty May, which is the dumbest idea you could possibly imagine, you know, for an anime. It's basically a magical girl, you know, who bounces around all over the place, and she has, you know, two mascots, you know, Lion Cubs, Posse King and Nega King. It's just the flimsiest, you know, most pandering sort of thing you can imagine. But they pour all their passion into it, and it makes them a success. But the thing is that the person who wrote that also wrote Royal Space Force. And he knows perfectly well the difference between what Gainax can do and what Gainax actually ended up doing much of the time. Gainax is capable of making these amazing otaku pandering things, but they know that's what they're doing. And they may like doing it, they may enjoy doing it, but they know that's not all they're capable of. They know they're capable of doing other things as well and capable of using their otaku insight in a different way. So I ended up with a zine. The zine actually was this weird thing where it's supposed to be a fanzine, right? But I thought there was a risk that people might actually end up liking Gainax less and liking Royal Space Force less because they had read the zine. I hope that's not how people feel, because I think on the contrary, you should have more admiration for it, because this sort of gives the full story of how Gainax was founded and what they really hope to achieve. You talk about the interview, the roundtable discussion they have that's in the zine about Royal Space Force. And it came a few months after the film was released. And even though the film didn't do too well for reasons, again, we get into the zine, they don't sound like defeated people. They don't sound like people who are just going to, you know, give in and, you know, make some totally pandering things. So I have to wonder whether that spirit is still there. And that challenge, I think, is still present in the works that not only they are making, but also in, that Gainax's alumni are making, you know, Trigger and Kara, the two studios that have split off from them in recent years.
Okay.
I think the Colony Drop guys should maybe say something at this point.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I was curious to get y'all's take on the film and how you think it's relevant now. Sean, why don't we start with you?
All right. Well, I think it's telling in a couple of interviews, Yamaga has mentioned that when Daikon Film first approached Bandai, they did it with the idea to make an OAV version of the Gundam MSV model kit line, which was kind of a spinoff of the original Gundam model kit line, which was super successful and was kind of a sign that they were trying to make some sort of new anime based on what little Gundam was existing right there, despite the huge fandom that exists for Gundam. And to me, I think that's interesting because it kind of speaks to the fact that even before they embarked on the much more artistic and arguably better Wings of Onyamis, they kind of had that mindset of knowing how to create a product that would appeal to otaku. And of course, I mean, history has kind of proven that right with all the Gundam spinoffs and new TV shows and just an insane amount of merchandising. And the people behind Gainax were smart enough to kind of think that that's something that would be worth pursuing, arguably even before Bandai did, because I think it was around the same time or shortly before Zeta Gundam was released. But to me, I think as much as I love Royal Space Force, I find the shift between Royal Space Force into Gunbuster kind of disheartening. And that as much as I might be kind of an otaku myself or exhibit otaku tendencies, ultimately, I'm a lot more attracted to films like Onyamis that kind of try to do something really unusual and try to do something different and kind of push the bar, whereas a lot of the later Gainax projects feel like they're still within that bar. I mean, they might be really smart, and I think Evangelion falls into that it might be a really smart production and have a lot of merit to it, but ultimately the basis of it is still built upon things that have already existed. Whereas to me, watching Onyamis, it feels like it's something kind of new, or at least it's just something different.
Yeah. In the zine, we talk about how Gunbuster is actually the reverse of Royal Space Force. It sort of takes all of the premises, all the reasons that Royal Space Force were made, and turns them on their head. And the punchline is that they were both written by the same person. Hiroyuki Yamaga wrote the screenplay for Gunbuster.
Right.
And it's meant in his biography, if you go on the Studio Kara website, Anno talks about how after Royal Space Force, he started to drift away from Gainax a little. But what brought him back? It was Yamaga's script for Gunbuster. And that changed the history of Gainax. You know, without that, they might not have gone on. But they went on by making, again, something like Gunbuster, which was 180 degrees in spirit different from, you know, Royal Space Force.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Carl, what you think. I think it was something that you wrote a few years back about how, whereas Miyazaki is a really strong, I think this was an interview you did with Okada, where like a guy like Miyazaki is a really strong force, and it's his vision, his films are his vision. Whereas Gainax, especially back in the Royal Space Force days, was everybody kind of making the film together. I wanted to ask you what you think the film might be like if it were directed by Anno or directed by one of the other guys at Gainax, whether it would be a very different film or whether it would be, because of that group process, almost the same film.
That's an interesting question. Anno, I think Anno's directorial experience at that point had been in live action, in the shorts they made as Daikon film. You have Takami Akai, who is the person who created the Princess Maker line of games, you know, and was really, again, very... Gainax certainly understands otaku, and they certainly understand otaku culture. But you have this guy who's known for drawing all these cute girls, but if you listen to him on the director's commentary, he completely understands the film, and he completely understands what they were trying to do there. So perhaps it wouldn't have been that different if, say, Akai had directed it. It just the idea that one of the things about Gainax that makes them often gives them difficulty in actually making anime is because historically they've all had to agree to something. You know, if everybody isn't feeling it, it doesn't get made. Now, it's one thing if they're doing like adaptations of work, like adaptations of someone other's manga, but if it's an original work, you know, they all kind of got to get behind it because they don't have that collective spirit. So I guess it may not necessarily be the person who actually directs it. It's just sort of everybody's got to agree that it's going to have this spirit and this tone and all that and sort of, you know, be willing to go along with it.
Jason, your thoughts on Oniyamis?
Yeah, the first time that I saw Royal Space Force, I think it was like right when Netflix kind of became a thing and all of a sudden I could get DVDs out, kind of like it was kind of like the second coming of being able to go to Blockbuster and watch all this stuff on the shelves. I missed Royal Space Force in that era. And I didn't really realize it at the time that, you know, it was this movie that was made through so much passion, and everybody was kind of, nobody had ever really done anything like this before on staff. And the director's commentary, they talk a lot about how, you know, they had all, it was mostly, you know, part-time college students who didn't come from an animation background, and everybody was just kind of trying to do whatever they could to make this film a reality. You know, they talk about how they made this guy who was just like, he had no talents that were actually useful to the production of the film, but he was a masseuse, and you know, he could give massages to folks on staff who you know were bent over their work desks all day. You know, stuff like that. And something that really stuck with me is I think Yamaga says at some point that he thought the unpolished feel of Royal Space Force was really appealing. And it's true, right? You know, Carl mentioned at the beginning of our little talk about this movie that, you know, sure, Evangelion 3.0 is in one sense a huge leap forward in terms of, you know, all the ways in which the industry has progressed over the past 25, 30 some years. But at the same time, it's like, man, you just don't have that same level of you know, the spirit of just being able to do anything that, you know, they set their minds to. They've in a sense regressed to making, well, I don't know. I haven't seen the third Ava film yet, but, you know, they're not pursuing those same kinds of you know, creative avenues the way that they used to. They're kind of, you know, stuck in this loop, sort of going after the same thing again and again. And I don't want to say that, you know, they can't possibly get that back necessarily, but, you know, it's something to think about for sure.
Well, I think it's kind of important to point out that, like, people talk about Gainax, they, you know, that studio at this point is split, you know, into three. Like, most of the talent that people associate with Gainax don't work there anymore. They made their own shit. they went on to start their own studios. And Evangelion went to Kara, and Trigger now is making the show that Gainax fans people who were Gainax fans in the 90s and in the mid 2000s are losing their shit over, which is Kill la Kill, every week. That show has people so excited from week to week, like Gainax shows used to do, back in the day. So the talent that people associate with Gainax, correct me if I'm wrong here, don't work there anymore.
Yeah, I think I saw a Twitter question actually asking about that, and I kind of thought the same thing.
I mean, Carl, you're the expert. You tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Well, certainly, as you say, Kara and Trigger have, broken off. It's really difficult to say where Gainax is going to go from here or what they can do from here. One person, interestingly, who has not put as much distance from Gainax as others might have is Yoshiyuki Sadamoto, who, of course, is the character designer for Evangelion Royal Space Force and basically is Gainax's signature character designer. He has associated himself with their new film project, Aoki Uru, which was announced, somewhat mysteriously last year at the Tokyo Anime Fair. And he's appeared at various events with Yamaga, talking about it. One thing that interests me about that is, first of all, Sadamoto is kind of a polymath. He's also a brilliant animator. Yasuo Otsuka, who was one of the mentors of Hayao Miyazaki, said that next to Miyazaki himself, Sadamoto was one of the most talented people he'd ever met. But also, in the years since Evangelion first came out, Sadamoto has also been known as the character designer for Mamoru Hosoda's films. Summer Wars, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, and Wolf Children. These have been relatively successful films, not as big as, Studio Ghibli, but certainly they've made money. So he's established himself as a bankable image, Sadamoto characters independently. He has established an identity for himself outside of Gainax, outside of Evangelion, and outside of Kara. I was talking with Emmanuel, who was the interpreter from France for Sadamoto at Japan Expo. And he said that when they were working on Summer Wars, Hosoda told Sadamoto, "Give me less Evangelion and give me more Royal Space Force." And I'm blanking on the name of the main female character in Summer Wars, but is it Natsumi? Do you remember? I probably got it wrong.
I don't remember.
but I remember watching it that she is supposed to be the cutest girl. And she's not, she wouldn't even be considered cute in like a regular otaku anime. It's like, you know what I mean. It's, he uses a more restrained character style. Right. It's not exactly blunt, though you see some of it in a lot of the supporting characters. But, Sadamoto has diversified himself a bit. And I know that he and Yamaga are rather close. Now, you can't make a movie just with Sadamoto, but it is sort of a creative, vote of confidence. There's some question about exactly how far apart the three studios are. I mean, they're obviously far apart in terms of what they're producing. But in terms of exchanges of personnel, between the staff and all that, between the studios, really, they haven't been put to that test yet. It definitely doesn't help, for example, to have Ima Ishii and Otsuka go to Trigger. But on the other hand, I'm not sure I can actually see those guys wanting to make a film like, Aoki Uru in the first place. They've got their own sense of things. The thing about Ima Ishii is, of Gainax's keynote directors, he's the only one who wasn't there from the beginning. He came in with Evangelion. Everybody else had been there, since before the days of Royal Space Force. Tsurumaki, actually, I think, came in with Gunbuster. He's the director of Furikuri. Anno and Yamaga, of course, were part of the original, trio that started it all. So it is kind of sad because Ima Ishii represented a true second generation. Kill la Kill is a fantastic show. It's just full of... This is going to sound terribly patronizing, but it kind of reminds me of like what got me into anime in the 1980s. People compare it to various things. One thing I compare it to is Urusei Yatsura. Particularly like the really crazy episodes where just like anything could happen. And there's this tremendous sense of energy, anarchy. And it also seems they've been planning ahead on the show, which is always a valuable, you know, thing. You don't have to plan everything out, you know. Evangelion, you know, sort of, you know, maybe prove that. But the, I mean, they did plan things out, but things didn't necessarily work exactly the way they planned. I think Kill la Kill is fantastic. One of the interesting things about the show is that a lot of people even now are mistaking it for a Gainax show. Now, in one important sense, of course, that's not true at all because, again, it's formed by Trigger, which split off from Gainax. In one abstract sense, it is true because Masahiko Otsuka has said that they didn't leave Gainax for creative reasons. You could clearly see, actually, Kill la Kill could be a Gainax show. There's no reason to make it. They just wanted more control over things like marketing, you know, and things of that sort. And you can see, actually, things like their Kickstarter thing. That's something that Gainax hasn't done, for example. There's no particular reason Gainax couldn't do a Kickstarter. It just doesn't appear to be their style. So I think that, you know, Trigger wants to speak more directly, you know, to the anime fans in the world. And I think actually that's a good thing. You know, it's something that maybe, you know, should be emulated. So I don't know. By putting out the idea that they are going to make this film Aoki Uru, and they've talked about a pilot film, that's sort of, you know, as De La Soul would say, you know, stakes are high. That's not, you know, they're sort of saying, well, we're going to do this thing we've been doing all this time. And of course, everybody knows about the split, you know, the split offs, you know, of their studio. So they did that nevertheless, regardless. You hear some strange rumors about Aoki Uru, about its production, but it's really hard to say, you know, whether there's any credence to those rumors. But all I can say is that, you know, we're just going to have to see, you know, what they can do and whether they can do it. You know, can they pass that test?
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, it's been a long time coming, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. For sure. I mean, wasn't it supposed to originally get made in, what, early 90s, somewhere around there?
Yeah, it's been a... I'm actually going to do a panel at SakuraCon talking about the history of the project. That's coming up, I guess, third week in April in Seattle. But what I was getting at is that, you know, because everybody knows that Gainax has been sort of reduced as a studio, if they wanted to make another original anime, they could have gone for something a bit, you know, less ambitious, like a more modest project. You know, make a sort of Little Witch Academia for Gainax, you know. But instead, you know, they're sort of, you know, going back for that long throw and doing Aoki Uru. And it's obvious to everybody this is like a tremendous, you know, chance. So they've just got to see what they can do with it. I mean, they've thrown down the gauntlet, and any more cliches or, you know, metaphorical images I can use, I've just run out of them, so.
Well, didn't they also recently mention or announce that they're doing another Daikon video for an upcoming convention?
I'm not sure. That seems to have been a misunderstanding. This year, 2014, is the 33rd anniversary of the original Daikon 3 video, which is in 1981.
Right.
And so they have a promo thing called Daikon 33, and they're selling various goods.
Yeah, I've seen that stuff.
I would question about whether they would be making a video, because they're supposed to be making this pilot film, right? And if there's some question about whether they can make a pilot film, and anybody who's seen, you know, the Royal Space Force DVD, the pilot film is all there. You can also see it on YouTube. The pilot film for Royal Space Force itself is pretty impressive. So I imagine the pilot film for Aoki Uru, it's also going to have to impress. So if they want to make that, it's hard to see how they would have time to make, like, another Daikon film.
All right. Well, we got some Twitter questions here that we should probably get to.
Okay.
Heck yeah.
Hey, Zach, sorry to interrupt. I got to take off, guys.
Oh, sure. No problem. Yeah, it's been going
on. Yeah. It was awesome.
Thanks so much.
Looking forward to hearing the rest of it.
Oh, sure. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Stay warm, Matt.
Take care, guys.
See you, man.
See you later.
First up, from .004, you guys working on Colony Drop, or are you guys working on another zine?
Sort of. Maybe. We've talked about it a little bit on Twitter, and we've been bouncing around ideas.
Yeah.
But at this point, there's nothing super concrete going on.
Well, you guys are talking about doing an all Pat Labor magazine, right?
That is correct.
Yeah.
I mean, the best I can say about that is I really like putting together those zines, but they're also a huge pain in the ass to do that and to just be chasing people down and getting it together and then deadlines and things like that. And,
yeah.
Well, you had a great Pat Labor article just in the most recent zine.
Yeah, that was Matt's. And that's kind of what spawned our idea to do that one.
Just wait till the live action comes out. You can just bitch about that for like 100 pages.
Oh, God. No, I suggested some stuff to Sean, and I've been slowly kind of doing the legwork on that. But basically all the things I suggested were probably the most time-consuming possible concepts for any given any subject. It's like, all right, I'm going to pick the two of the most time-consuming things I could possibly pick here. So,
I mean,
I fully yeah.
To date, I've got two articles for a Pat Labor fanzine submitted, and kind of intentionally, when we think about those things, we tell people to not write timely articles, and to write articles that could still be worthwhile in a year or two. Mm-hmm. So I think at this point we'll just see what we can put together, and hopefully it'll turn into a cool project, but it might not. So
okay. Also from .004, what zines from back in the day did Carl take influence from for his RSF 25 zine, and which zines did you read back in the day?
Oh, well, actually, we kind of, in the centerfold of the zine, we kind of pay tribute to some of the zines that inspired me back in the early 90s. I guess in terms of zines that that covered anime, and I think part of what made zines interesting was they rarely talked not just about anime but about other things going on as well. And, you know, that's part of what gave them their interest, the fact that they're connected, you know, to people's social lives, you know, what the bands are saying and things of that sort. It made it more fun, you know, less isolated. But I guess probably the big three would have been, first of all, Saikomu Gaijin, which is from Minneapolis. And again, we're talking early 90s here. A really really funny bunch of guys. And also one of the people who was part of their scene is the interpreter and translator, Dan Kanemitsu, who's from that area. And the cool thing about that is they would do articles about doujinshi, and when most people think of doujinshi, they think of what you can find in a dealer's room, basically books that are straight up parodies of like anime, you know, and live action movies and so forth. And the reason that's what you see here in America is because if you pick up a box of doujinshi, it's heavy. They're print stuff, you know, it's all got to be sent from Japan because that's where it's made. So the stuff that gets imported over here to be sold in the U.S. is stuff that they're pretty sure is going to sell. You know, they're going to have a bunch of Attack on Titan stuff and Kill la Kill and all that. But in Japan, doujinshi are just fanzines. So yeah, a lot of them are like that, and maybe the majority of them are like that. But there's so many of them. There's also a whole bunch of doujinshi that are kind of – they're more like Colony Drop. They're article-oriented. You know, they might have some manga content, but they also, you know, mix it up with, you know, photography and different styles. And so what Dan Kanemitsu was writing about 20 years ago is he was saying, hey, this is happening in Japan too. And he was giving this whole story about the Japanese fanzine scene. So I was kind of lucky to run into Saikomu Gaijin because it sort of gave me an early image of like what the Japanese fanzine was like. Another of the zines that I was into was associated with the Cornpone Flicks guys in Atlanta, and many of them today are part of running the convention Anime Weekend Atlanta. Zines like Let's Anime and Oxygen Destroyer, and they came from the same group. Again, there's a lot of talk in there about 60s anime, which was kind of new to me. I'm sympathetic to people who like are reluctant to go check out 80s anime, because to be honest, there's so much anime happening right now. That's a lot of work just to keep up with what's on TV. And when I became an otaku in the 80s, I didn't like rush out and immediately go see all the classics from the 60s and 70s. I didn't want to see that. I was too busy, you know, watching Elgaim and, you know, and Urusei Yatsura. You know, maybe I should have, but it's only natural that, you know, you want to see what's happening and, you know, what's exciting now. So years later, you know, I get educated by, you know, zines like Let's Anime, again, Oxygen Destroyer. The third anime zine that kind of inspired me was from England. It's called Trash City. It was done by a guy named Jim McLennan. And he would talk not only about anime, but also Hong Kong films, which were big back then. Jim McLennan was the first person who ever made what I thought was a cool anime video. Anime videos had been around for a long time, but it was almost like, okay, the music's cool, and that anime's cool, and it's cool that you put them together, but somehow it's not adding up to anything else. It's like, it's almost like people didn't know that video music videos are supposed to be like, that some music video directors are better than others, you know, and like, you're supposed to take it to that other level. And Jim McLennan made this great anime music video to Nightmare at 20,000 Feet by Pop Will Eat Itself. Pop Will Eat Itself was a British band. It was very, very beloved of otaku at the time. And it was so cool. It was so energetic. And the video kind of expressed the same vibe I was getting from the zine. Because the whole point of zines, to me, the whole reason zines are interesting is because they kind of say, oh, wow, this is like a fresh way of looking at it. Like, you just don't have to sit down in a chair and, like, glue your eyes to the screen. You know, this person's got a different perspective on things. A few years later, I discovered a zine called Empty Space. Again, we're talking about zines which are oriented towards anime or manga culture. It was founded by two people. One's an artist named Eli Vassilopoulos. He did a great comic a lot of people have seen out there. It's called The Con Where Anime Died. Have you guys read it?
No.
No.
You might have seen it. It's the one where Miyazaki, Anno, and Oshii get into a literal death match with each other. It's pretty funny. But the other person who founded Empty Space was Aaron Rauch, who was a photography student at CalArts. And Aaron was the first otaku I met who was using a camera at a convention to do something other than taking shots of cosplayers posing. Instead, he'd like take pictures of cosplayers when they weren't posing, when they were talking to their friends or waiting in a line or sitting down tired. And suddenly you were seeing not only the costume and the pose, but you're seeing the person who came to do the costume and the pose. And he'd take these pictures in black and white. You consider how brightly colored anime is and how brightly colored cosplay is. That was kind of an act of discipline, self-discipline, and an artistic way of, you know, an alternative way of seeing ourselves. Getting back to Royal Space Force, those are qualities I think that anime needs. It always needs the ability to see ourselves, you know, from a different angle. And this guy, Aaron Rauch, he wasn't some sociologist, you understand. He wasn't coming to a con to document the otaku subculture. He was an otaku. He was running anime clubs. He was learning Japanese, listening to soundtracks, the whole bit. He wasn't doing it to be pretentious any more than Gainax made Royal Space Force to be pretentious. He just realized that you can see more things if you actually look in a different way for once. So I just want to talk about zines in general. I really should. It wasn't just that. Lalo Alcaraz and Esteban Zul, they did this great Chicano fanzine called Pocho. And this is during the Pete Wilson era and the NAFTA debates. So they had plenty of material. Not only was it funny and had great cartoons, but they promote the zine in the same spirit they put it together. So you'd see people at the San Diego Comic-Con standing in the dealer's room, not in a booth or at a table, but they'd be hawking it in the aisles. And they'd be dressed as, you know, Lucha Libre masks, you know, and capes, you know, Mexican superheroes. So this is cosplay as social satire. And I loved it because, again, it was like, they were promoting the zine in the same spirit they made it. And again, you get so energized and you see somebody who's doing something different, something cool. And one more zine I should mention. I also discovered this at the San Diego Comic-Con in the 90s. It has to be David Walker's Badass Mofo, which specialized in blaxploitation films, but didn't just talk about things like Shaft and Superfly. It talked about the larger picture of black actors and black filmmakers and their relationship to an industry where they rarely had financial or creative control. He'd talk about these movies from the era that became obscure, not because they were no budget or trashy, but because they didn't fit into the narrow definition of, you know, blaxploitation as pimps and private eyes. He got me into movies like The Spook Who Sat by the Door and Together Brothers and Killer of Sheep. These are all black 1970s films, but they couldn't be, you know, more different from another. So to me, the really cool thing that a zine can do is it can be somebody who's like a totally obsessed fan and who has all this knowledge, you know, this obscure knowledge, but they present it in a way that feels cool and fresh and interesting. And you may not know anything about this subculture they're talking about. I think the best zine could be something that you didn't even think you were interested in, but just the way they're presenting it, hey, suddenly you are interested in it, you know? So it's not just otaku talking to other otaku. It's otaku, you know, reaching people, you know, actually communicating. I think that's one of the things, great things about a zine and, you know, one of the goals.
Okay. Well, we got a lot of questions about whether or not Gainax is still relevant or creatively weaker as a result of all these sort of spin-off studios. You know, there's a lot of these, and I kind of want to just combine them all into one, like whether or not you think Gainax is creatively weaker, whether or not you think they're still relevant, and do you think they can come back from this?
Well, as we kind of talked about earlier, I mean, even though they've been split into these different studios in a way at this point, you know, we've got all of these shows that are exciting to one group of people or another, and they're finally going to get to make this thing that they've clearly wanted to make for a very, very long time. I don't know if the final verdict is that they're weaker necessarily. It's just like they're all over the place, you know?
Yeah, it's and again, like if you were to go back to Gainax, what did they make right after Furikuri? They made Mahoromatic, you know, and that was back in 2001 before Trigger split off, before Kara split off, you know, when they still had the whole gang together. So, you know, you can find Mahoromatic, again, ironically, was the return to directing of Hiroyuki Yamaga. It was the first thing he had directed since Royal Space Force. But and it was a modestly successful, you know, work in its own way, you know, on DVD and so forth. A lot of people, otaku, did like it. But, you know, in terms of progressing the medium and all that, it's quite a switch from Furikuri, you know, to Mahoromatic. So it's not like Gainax's, you know, ups and downs are a new thing. And again, it depends on, you know, what era in their history you pick. You can make the argument that Kara, you know, Anno Studio, has not yet been put to the test. The test will be when they make their first thing that's not Evangelion. And yes, I know they've, you know, they made other things before, but what I mean is their first, you know, big work. As an anime fan, and just speaking selfishly, my dream ideal scenario for Kara would be that they're making these Evangelion films to train animators. They're getting a lot of experience. They're getting their name out there. And at the end of it, they'll build up a big, you know, cash position. So they have more financial security than most anime studios. And at that point, then they take off. Then they go and, you know, could become another Gainax, could become another Ghibli. That's what I would like to see. That's just speaking, however, from like an anime fan's perspective. I don't know if that's what Anno wants, you know, or what he intends to do. I make a remark about Evangelion in the zine, you know, that if Anno couldn't save anime with the original Evangelion, he can't save anime. You know, he gave anime everything he had in that thing. You know, he gave his soul, he gave his heart, he gave everything he had as an artist. If there is one thing that Evangelion, the original Evangelion, is above all else, it's sincere. He means it. He's not just, you know, making another show. It may be messy. It may be confusing, but it's passionate and there's a real person behind it. You know, he paid a big price, you know, personally, you know, for that. And I was amazed he could ever, you know, come back to Evangelion. You know, who knows? Maybe the Evangelion movies, you know, are to the original Evangelion the way The Wind Rises is to the original, you know, designer of the Zero. You know, they're a rewriting, a fresh, you know, writing of the history. But we're just going to have to see. I give Trigger a great deal of credit because Trigger took a big chance. Kill la Kill was an original concept. It's not based on anything. In retrospect, you say, of course, yeah, Kill la Kill, it's awesome. They should have made it. But But, you know, there's so much timidity in the industry. And, you know, who was to say it? You know, it could have been, you know, it could have been a giant flop. It takes guts, you know, to strike out, you know, and do something original. Whether Kill la Kill is the kind of groundbreaking anime the way Royal Space Force was, the way Evangelion was, the way Furikuri was. And I feel weird calling them groundbreaking because, like, the ground they broke wasn't necessarily followed up upon. You know, they all showed different ways you could be. But I'm not sure that people necessarily took that as an example or a lesson. But certainly, Kill la Kill has life and guts and energy to it. And right now, that's more than enough. And again, they took the chance. They took the chance to make something original when there's so much, you know, timidity in the industry. So, you know, I give them tremendous credit. Gainax is unusual as a studio because they have had four different directors, you know, who were able to make something distinct and worthwhile. You know, Yamaga, Anno, Sotomaki, and Imaishi. Most studios will never be able, you know, to do that. So we'll just have to see.
Okay, and I think that's actually a pretty good place to wrap us up here. Again, huge thanks to you guys for stopping by. That was a very enlightening conversation about all that stuff. So, Carl, thanks for showing up. And Jason and Sean and Matt had to leave a little earlier, but big thanks to you guys for coming on the show.
Thank you, Zach.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, Zach. And once again, thanks to Colony Drop, because if it wasn't for your zine, I would not have made mine. So you're a big inspiration.
Well, thank you, Carl. That means quite a bit to us.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Carl and the Colony Drop crew for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a little rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.